Currently 37 degrees outside. And joining us in studio today for Greenside Up is James Coover and David Scrantz. Guys, good morning. How are you doing this morning?
Doing good.
How are you?
Doing pretty good. And before we get started with our subjects today, first of all, there are a couple of workshops that are upcoming.
Yes. And so this one is today, actually. It's today in a couple of hours. So the State Line Crops Conference, this is a all virtual conference, and so you can make it because, you know, you don't have to go anywhere.
Right. Not going to be that late.
Yes, yeah. And so let us know soon if you want to get signed up for this. We can send you the links and all that. We're going to start off with Dan O'Brien. He's going to be talking about the grain markets and the weird things they're doing. Next, we're going to talk about the economics of soybean fungicide. And then after lunch, we're going to be talking about tile drainage, which is kind of an odd topic around here and a little bit exceptional. So, you know, don't want to miss that. If you're a crops farmer, you know, please call one of the Wildcat Extension or the Southwind Extension offices, and we'll get you sent the links for that, or any office, really. So, right after that, as in next week on December the 8th, this will be the Corn Marketing Workshop, and I've talked about this for about 2 months now. This corn marketing workshop is going to be covering basically everything when it comes to looking at the futures, as in, you know, calls, puts, options, developing an effective marketing plan, looking at the seasonality of corn prices and putting this all together into a marketing plan. And so this will be on December the 8th at 9:30 to 2:30. This is will be only in person. And so Ann will be at the Erie Community Building on the fairgrounds there. So.
And then coming up the following week on December 15th, we'll have a farm succession workshop from 6 to 7:30 in the evening. We'll be holding that in three locations at the Hepler Library, Oswego Community Center, and the Wilson County Courthouse, or you can also join this one virtually. And we'll be having Lavelle Windsor. She's a farm analyst specialist who will be speaking at the workshop and covering the 12 steps of succession planning.
All right, so a couple of great workshops coming up, and we'll go ahead and get it started today, and we'll start with James here in the first part of the show today. And what you're going to be talking about today, James, ag leases and lease laws.
Yes, so tis the season for lease laws. I mean, that's pretty much, I don't know, 80% of the questions that we get at the Extension office right now.
Yeah.
For the next 2 months, it has to do with leasing. So, I mean, 50% of the agricultural land in Kansas is leased. I mean, it's just the way of the world now, really. Farm families kind of leave the farm. Somebody else takes it over. Their farm operation grows bigger. That's just the way of it. And so, you know, leasing is a very important part to get correct because of all of this that is done. Ag contracts, they run from a March 1st to March 1st basis. That's very common, whether most of the time, unless it's written differently. If it's an oral lease, that's how it works. If you're going to change your contract this year, it needs to be done 30 days before March 1st. Most contract owners, you know, they know this. That change in contract, if you're going to terminate a lease, it has to be in writing. That doesn't matter whether you have a written lease or an oral release. It has to be, that part of it has to be in writing. And so, you know, 30 days before March 1st, and that's January 28th or 29th, use registered mail when you send that termination letter. A termination letter is actually very simple. It's just a description of the property, you know, terminating the lease, and some names, honestly. It's just a few lines long. So there are some complications, though, when you're terminating a wheat crop, basically. And so if a field has already been planted to wheat, you can't terminate that lease, you know, at a normal time because it's still on there. That farmer owns that wheat. So what you do in that case is you actually set the termination date to March 1st, but the effective termination date is actually the day after harvest, and so sometime in mid-June. That's really kind of the only area where it's a little bit different, but it hasn't really, usually it's not much of an issue. Some other rules when it comes to leasing. You can't transfer oral leases without asking the landlord. Basically, you know, and this has actually happened. I've had a call recently where this happened, where somebody, you know, they're an out-of-state landowner. This is land from their family from a long time ago. Well, the farmer that was farming it retired and transferred the lease without the landlord knowing to just one of his business partners, pretty much, because all farmers, you know, they farm together and they have different operations. And so you can't actually transfer that without letting the landlord know. That's a change in lease. That's a sublease, technically. So it is important to let them know. Technically, from, you know, written leases are becoming more and more common, but the vast majority of them are still oral leases, and that's an issue. Almost always, if there's going to be some sort of issue later on, it starts to form with an oral lease that isn't known. Maybe, you know, a grandparent dies and a lease turns into something. Nobody knows what that lease is or what the written terms are, and it starts to get messy. Right. So it's almost always better to have a written lease. And there are some pieces in Kansas law that don't cover every aspect. I'm going to talk a little bit about that later. And so a written lease needs to cover those aspects. Kansas law doesn't really do that great of a job.
And plus, that just covers everybody, just in case there could be an issue that arises. That covers pretty much everything that could happen.
Yes, yes. And there are a lot of issues that happen. I mean, as extension agents, we get a number of calls just dealing with people who don't really know what the law is, and there's a complication somewhere, and it's almost always a miscommunication between a landlord and a lessee. And so one aspect is noxious weeds, for instance. Noxious weeds are complex in that fact that from the county's perspective, both the landlord and the lessee have an obligation to take care of noxious weeds. So from the county's perspective, it's complex of who really needs to pay money to take care of this stuff. So there's really no part in Kansas law that says this person or this person. So really both of them are actually responsible. Most people ask two questions. If it's a crop share landlord, the question is almost always, am I supposed to be paying for herbicides? Am I supposed to be paying, because herbicides are expensive, and they've been going up in prices considerably in the last few years. And so, you know, after the pesticide and the herbicide and the fertilizer and, you know, maybe a lime application every 8 years or so, the landlord is wondering, like, I'm not hardly making any money off of this. Like, I'm barely paying the taxes. Well, yeah, that tends to be the case. But, yeah, I mean, technically speaking, the vast majority of crop share leases, the landlord does help with the herbicide and the pesticide. It's a part of the operation. That's not an absolute, though. I mean, there are a number of leases out where the landlord doesn't pay for some of that stuff. So it's not precision. There's no preciseness in Kansas law there. When it comes to cash rent, though, the question is almost always, am I getting a fair amount? And that is, we don't have great data on that, honestly. The NASS, the Natural Agriculture Statistics Service, they do collect some data, and we use that data a lot in extension. But, you know, a lot of people don't turn in their lease forms. They don't turn that information into the government, and so they can't put it together and get it back. So what we're actually going to try to do is do a leasing for me and Wendy are trying to do a lease for the Wildcat District, trying to do our own local lease, and hopefully we'll get a few more people to fill it out. So if you see one of those leases, please help us out or one of those forms, please help us out by filling it in, turning it in. Of course, everything will be confidential and all that, and we'll aggregate the data so nobody will know what it is specific you get. So I think after the break, I'll probably talk about fence laws and some hunting laws and just some other aspects that you can kind of add on to your leasing contracts are very important.
All right, and we'll talk more about that after the break, and we're going to talk to Davin just for a moment. And Davin, before we go to a break, just kind of want to give everybody, what can we expect from you in the second half of the program?
Yeah, in the second half of the program, I'll be talking a little bit about heat lamps and heat lamp safety. As the weather gets colder, people are more likely to use heat lamps to help keep their animals warm. And there's just some precautions that you want to take to help keep everyone safe and avoid a barn fire.
All right. Yeah, we don't want anything like the Great Chicago Fire, you know, happening. What the rumor was still that the cow started set the entire city on fire.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we come back on the other side of the break, we'll have some more Green Side Up. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. And welcome back. It's now time again for our second part of Greenside Up here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. Joining me in studio this morning is James Coover and Davin Skrantz. Guys, welcome back.
Yeah,
hi.
All right. For anybody that may have missed the first part of the show today, you guys do have a couple of workshops that you are offering, including one happening today.
Yes. So the one happening today is a virtual conference. It's the State Line Crops Conference. Between us and Missouri. So we're going to start off today with the Green Market Update with Dan O'Brien, talking about the economics of soybean fungicide. And then after the break, we're going to talk about tile drainage. That'll be today from 10 to 1. If you're interested, please give your local extension office a call and we'll send you the links for it. Next week on December the 8th, we're going to the Grain Marketing Workshop. This will be an in-person, in-depth workshop talking about how to effectively market grain. That'll be in Erie from 9:30 to 2:30.
And then coming up on December 15th, that evening from 6 to 7:30, we'll be having a Farm Succession Workshop in Hepler, Oswego, Fredonia, or you can also join that one virtually. Lavelle Windsor, who is a farm analyst, will be covering the 12 steps of succession planning. Yeah, if I can talk. So to register for that workshop, you can call our Girard office at 620-724-8233.
All right. So again, some great workshops going on, including one coming up today. Be sure to set up for that. Okay. James is just in the microphone over there. All right. So James, we'll come back to you. Of course, we were talking about ag leases here for a bit, and we'll come back to you here in just a second. But we're going to go to Davin first. And Davin, what you'll be talking about today is heat lamps to help heat your barn, but also there could be some dangers involved as well using those.
Yes, so the weather has gotten colder. There's even a slight chance of snow tomorrow, and a common way for livestock owners or even other animal owners to help keep their animals warm during the cold weather is to use heat lamps. Generally speaking, adult animals don't need a heat lamp as an extra source of heat, as long as they have, of course, a shelter where they can keep get out of the wind and rain and the bad weather, unless they're sick. But young animals, especially in December, producers may start having lambs and kids being born. So those younger animals, they do need a little bit of extra warmth during the cold weather. And some people may also have chicks or rabbits or some smaller animals that also need to stay warm. So in addition to providing food, water, and a good shelter, a heat lamp can provide an extra source of warmth. And another source of warmth that is often used is straw or shavings in the barn or coop to help keep animals warm. And when you combine a heat lamp with straw or shavings, you do have a risk of fire danger there, unfortunately. So to help prevent that risk, it's important to use a quality heat lamp. There are many factors that affect the quality of a heat lamp, and if the heat lamp is poorly made, it can lead to an increased chance of it causing a fire. So when you're looking at heat lamps, some things that to look at that will indicate their quality is you want to avoid short, thin cords, poor connections to the fixture, unreliable attachment points for hanging, and just general cheap construction are factors that will reduce the quality of the heat lamp. And there's even some styles of heat lamps now that aren't metal, which will heat up a little bit, but they're all a hard plastic, and they also have a cage protecting the bulb. So even if it were to fall, the bulb would stay inside the heat lamp and reduce the risk of breaking. And then, of course, along with that is when you hang a heat lamp up, you want to make sure it's hung in a secure fashion. I know that a lot of times it gets cold overnight, or you see that there's a chance of snow, so you want to hang up the heat lamp maybe really quick before you go to work, and baling twine may be a really easy and convenient choice, but you really want to try and go with something more secure, such as baling wire, or even if you have the time, attaching a good, like, strong chain that you can hang the heat lamp on. And also try and get it up in a way where animals can't easily chew on the cord, or if it's attached with twine, chew on the twine and then it end up falling because of one of those reasons. And then also the bulb that you use in the heat lamp is also important. You want to use one of the harder glass bulbs so that if it does fall, there's less chance of the bulb breaking and shattering.
Which would not be a good thing at all. So probably a chain is probably the best thing to use, since it's a lot more sturdy than, say, twine or wire.
Yes, ideally a chain would be good to use, and it will differ a little bit depending if you're hanging them up for lambs and kids, or if you're setting it up in maybe a chicken coop for chicks, or maybe you even have a rabbit that you want to keep warm. Then you might be able, some heat lamps come with clips where you can clip them to, like, the side of the cage or a coop that way.
Go ahead.
You know, with chicks, you know, you have, if the heat lamp is the right spot, they'll form like a circle, right? Because right in the middle, yeah, it's too hot, on the outside, right, it's too cool, so they'll form a perfect little circle.
Yeah.
Is that the same thing with, like, lambs and sheep? Will they actually form like a circle when you have it in the perfect spot?
Yeah, they will. They'll all gather up. It's really cute because it'll just be a little pile of lambs or kids laying under the heat lamp.
Just getting the perfect spot, you know?
And maybe, like, sometimes if the heat lamp is a little too low, so it gets a little too warm for them, then they'll, like, maybe move off to the edge or to a little corner and all pile up there.
It's like they're having a meeting at that point, you know, just a guy in a circle. So again, that's some great tips for heat lamps. Do you guys have any more tips, like, on the K-State website about heat lamps?
I believe we might have one of my old radio recordings on the Wildcat District website, but of course you can contact me at the Extension office as well if you have any more questions about heat lamps.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much. And we're going to go ahead and get back to James. And James, we're going to talk about the second part of ag leases that you were talking about in the first part of the show.
Yes. And so when I was talking, the first part of the show is just general lease laws. But there are some pieces to Kansas laws that are a little bit undefined, I guess you could say. And so two areas that commonly come up that are issues are fence laws and also hunting laws. Hunting laws, especially around here. And so fences actually, there are some laws, but they're not always complete for most situations because there's lots of situations. Basically, the fence dividing two pieces of land is the responsibility of both landowners. But issues, of course, do arise. We often not go by the right-hand rule here. Basically, the right-hand part of the half of the fence is your responsibility. Oddly enough, that's not actually a law. That's just, I don't know, just the way that we do things. It's kind of a law because that's the way we understand it.
It's kind of an understanding.
Yeah. And so fences, another odd thing about fences is that they're not always on the property line. Property lines actually move a little bit here and there because over the years people will build a fence. Well, then it gets filled up with trees or whatever. You move the fence, you know, a few feet this way or a few feet that way. And over the years, eventually that new fence, wherever it's at, becomes the new property line. And so you'd be surprised if you actually ever did a survey of your farmland that it's not exactly where it used to be. So one thing is that someone with livestock cannot require someone without livestock, let's say the crop, it's a crop owner on the other side, they cannot require them to build a fence. Although damage caused by not having an adequate fence on his part of the fence, basically the right-hand part of the crop owner's fence, isn't really the responsibility as well. And so even if you can't really require someone to build a fence, if you're a cattle owner onto a crop owner, but that crop owner is still responsible for maintaining a fence that is there. And so there's a lot of issues that arise with that crop owners think that they have no responsibility to the fence if it's cattle on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not entirely true, actually. And so, you know, really it's both parties' responsibility to maintain that fence and to make sure the cattle aren't getting onto it. But there are a lot of oddities about fence laws. There's a lot of oddities about what is actually a legal fence. I think technically speaking, like, you know, 4 feet of rocks stacked up 18 inches is a legal fence in Kansas, or three wire, but if it's barbed is a legal fence, or four wire if it's not barbed, or, you know, there's a lot of odd things. Actually, one strand of electrified wire is technically a legal fence. I wouldn't trust that in all situations,
right. Like,
especially if the cattle are gonna right next to a highway. But that, you know, we use those in the middle of pastures all the time, you know, one strand hot wires. Besides the fence laws, hunting laws is the real big situation. Maybe David can help me with some of this stuff. A landlord, and this was another call I got recently, a landlord cannot lease ground to hunt if they have leased the ground for cattle or crops. And so when you lease ground, it's that landowner or the lessee has become the de facto responsible party for that land. And so the landowner actually can't even hunt on that ground him or herself as either. And so, you know, that's a common misconception that people have, is that when you lease land, you could still go on to it and cut firewood and hunt and do all that. You actually can't. And so there are only some specific situations where you're legally allowed to go on to that land. However, a leaser cannot sublease that ground for hunting. And so there's really no situation that you can actually sublease land from someone without the landowner's permission.
So once you have it leased for one thing, you can't be leasing it for something else. It's leased for that and that only.
Yes, and only to you.
Right.
And so, but there's another part, and I actually don't know this situation. And so technically, if you've leased land yourself, I don't know that it's not legal for you specifically, not somebody else, but you specifically, to hunt that land. However, if you do, you're also not using that land within the terms of the original lease or within the original intent of the original lease. And so that is kind of a gray area that I'm not really sure about, actually. Like, do you have any idea, David, whether...
I'm not sure about that either. That's a good question
for
us to look into more.
And so that I'm not sure. Basically, if you've leased land and somebody wants to hunt it, it really needs to be a discussion between the landlord and the lessee. Really, any hunting involved needs to be a discussion, because that's kind of a hot topic. And so, and of course, in all situations, having a written lease, like I say many times, having a written lease is the best situation, and having a hunting clause in there is very important.
All right. So again, some great topics there, and be sure to if anybody has questions about any of these items that we've talked about today, how can they get a hold of each of you guys?
They can give, you know, any of the Wildcat or any of the extension offices a call. The number for Gerard is 620-724-8233.
And I'm usually at the Independence office. That phone number is 620-331-2690. But like James said, if you call any of the offices, they can transfer the call and reach me as well.
All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming in today. We really do appreciate it. And we will see you guys next week.
Thank you.
All right. That was Greenside Up with James Coover and David Skrantz. We appreciate them coming in today. And we're getting ready to start open line. So give us a call at 620-251-6909. 1-800-252-5443. 1-800-252-KGGF. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF.